This is the April 13th, 2023 regular meeting of the Stanford Community Resource Group, 6:30 p.m.
Count above seven.
So, good evening, everyone. So, we're at 6:30, so maybe we can get started. So, I just like to make an announcement that we've been recording this meeting.
The mother can fly up there.
We've got the recording started, so. Okay,
that's
so
cool. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
So good to see you all after, 2-3 years of a hiatus. We were not meeting in person. So it's wonderful to see everybody in person. Thank you for joining the Stanford Community Resources Group meeting today. I'm Charu Aluwalia, Senior Planner and Stanford Program Manager. We also have from county staff Robert Salisbury, Principal Planner. So maybe Rob, you could introduce yourself to the group.
Sure. As Charu said, I'm Rob Salisbury, and I'm a Principal Planner with the county.
And we also have Christina Loquez from Super Estimating's District 5 office. So Christina, would you like to share a few words?
Just, I'm here to listen and learn, and I think most of you, I know I've not met all of you, but look forward to seeing what you have to say today.
Okay, wonderful. So we can then begin. So I'll start with item one on the agenda, which is a call to order. So I'd like to take a roll call. So Alice Kaplan, Arushi Gupta, Betsy Nash.
Yes.
Ed Lowing.
Here.
Jerry Hearn.
Here.
Jim Sweeney.
Here.
Mary Okiki. Olivia Fu. Peter Drickmeyer.
Here.
Priya Graves.
Here.
Tom Blasek.
Here.
Okay, so we have a quorum.
Good.
Okay, so. So I know Betsy's been a part of the community resource group one time, but maybe, you know, not everybody knows you. If you'd like to introduce yourself, because you're rejoining the CRG, so to say.
I am rejoining, very happily. And Betsy Nash, city council member for Menlo Park, and very happy to be back.
Yeah, and Ed, this is Ed Lowing's first meeting.
Yep.
So Ed, would you like to share a few words?
Yep, I'm the new city council member from Palo Alto. And before that, I was involved in Planning Commission for about 6 years and Parks Commission for about 7 years before that. So not new to the city, but new to that particular seat. Not even new to that dais, because we use that same dais. different situation entirely. So and I guess I'm here now instead of Lydia Koo last year, who's now our mayor.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so item two on the agenda is public comment. So if anybody wishes to speak and address the CRG on a topic not on the agenda, you can please raise your hand. So do we have any speakers? Okay, seeing none, we can move on to item number three. So item number three, which is the main item on the agenda today, is review of the Stanford Annual Report 2022. So I'll be providing a brief presentation on this item, and after which we'll open up a public comment. I believe Stanford would like to share a few comments as well, and then we'll take questions and comments from the CRG. So I'll need to pivot to the podium here because my laptop can't get the cable as far. So let me get started. Okay, so maybe for the benefit of the newer members, we can do a quick summary, and we'll keep a presentation really pithy and short. But to get started, this is some background. On December 12th of 2000, the County of Santa Clara approved the Stanford University Community Plan and the General Use Permit. The SCP policies, along with the GUP conditions, provide regulatory framework for all development on Stanford campus. The 2000 GUP provides a cap on academic building areas, student housing units, parking spaces, childcare, and temporary research space. And the numbers are detailed on the slide. The purpose of the Stanford Community Annual Report is to document development activity on Stanford campus and monitor compliance with required mitigation measures and conditions of approval. The report is presented to the Community Resource Group and Planning Commission each year. And for ER22, the report period is September 1st, 2021 to August 31st, 2022. So this annual report tracks compliance with 108 conditions of approval. The focus of this brief presentation is on academic square footage and transportation. And details on the remaining condition compliance are available in the annual report, which was shared with the CRG group and stakeholders last Thursday. So since the year 2000 up to the current reporting period, the square footage of cumulative development building permits approved in Stanford are an approximate of 1.74 million square feet. And this is, you know, depicted in the diagram on the screen. As of August 31st, 2022, GUP square footage remaining for allocation is 299,398 square feet. So just a clarification here, square footage is counted against the GUP building area cap in the particular reporting year after the building permits have been approved. So that's how the reporting has been done for the past 20 plus years. With regards to housing, the total number of campus housing units constructed under the 2000 GUP thus far is 4,423. During the annual report 20 reporting period, 2,020 new housing units were completed via the Escondido Village Graduate Residences project, and a total of 45 housing units remain available under the housing allowance. As of August 31st, 2022, Stanford has made cumulative in-lieu affordable housing fee payments totaling an approximate of $39.35 million. And affordable housing square footage bank has also been maintained by the county since the year 2000. This is for demolition or conversion of projects that remove buildings from the GUP allocation. So instead of paying in-lieu fees, Stanford has the option to use the bank square footage. For this reporting period, Stanford paid no in-lieu fee, and no square footage from the bank was used. So again, I would like to note here that there is a GUP condition, specifically F6, which requires Stanford to construct affordable housing units or make affordable housing payments that are equal to, as you know, as decided through the GUP process, which is equal to the City of Palo Alto's housing impact fee for commercial or resource and development, which at this time is at a rate of about $68.50 per square foot. So the per the GUP condition, the county charges Stanford the fee when the academic development is constructed, and this is prior to occupancy of the building. So in this reporting period, all of the Stanford projects are still under construction for the reporting period, thus no final occupancy has been requested. Thus, therefore, there has been no affordable housing in-lieu fee payment made by Stanford. Okay, moving on to traffic, with regards to the traffic monitoring, 2022 represents the first year of a full data collection for the traffic monitoring period after the 2019 campus shutdown took place because of COVID-19. And the campus shutdown took place in March 2020, so there's been a gradual return. But since the fall of 2021, the traffic monitoring program has gone to the full data collection. So for this year, 6 weeks of data was collected in spring and 2 weeks of data was collected in fall. So based on the analysis and report on the traffic monitoring, the conclusion of the report was that the adjusted morning AM inbound count was 1,004 trips lower than the baseline that was set in 2001. And for the afternoon inbound counts, it was 600 trips below the 2001 PM baseline count. So in conclusion, no net new trip standard was met by Stanford. So Stanford is in compliance for the traffic monitoring. So I would like to, you know, just conclude here that in summary, the staff was able to find that Stanford's 22nd annual report demonstrates compliance with conditions of approval as was stipulated in the 2000 GUP. And I'll conclude my presentation and, you know, we can have a discussion and we open it up for comments. Thank you. Okay, so with that, we can open up for public comment. If there are no members of the public wishing to speak, maybe I know Stanford would like to share a few comments, so I can request one of the representatives from Stanford to do so.
Right, my name is Ramya Subramanian. Nice to meet all of you. I am with the Land Use and Environmental Planning Office at Stanford. Just want to add a couple pieces more of information. Thank you so much for your hard work to get this report going, Taru, and sending it to the CRG for their review a week prior, and also for your expert presentation. So I just wanted to add that Stanford University had a smooth transition to post-pandemic setting. Now our students and faculty are fully in person, and we are very grateful for that. The other pieces you may have observed in our GUP table in the report that most of our approvals are demolition approvals, and so we are taking a hard look on our buildings and spaces on campus, and those buildings that currently are not capable of desirable future programming, we are trying to see if we can replace them and use our GUP more efficiently going forward. I do want to mention that two new building projects, one is the Graduate School of Education, the other one is the Bridge Building, which is the Interdisciplinary Data Science Building next to the Oval. Those two new building construction projects have just started, and we're grateful for campus staff to have worked on the ASA approval package, which came through last year. Just want to also highlight Table 6 in the annual report. It has a tranche of projects that are under review by the county. And most of them, I would say a handful of them, are renovations to our athletic facilities, and a couple of them are sidewalk improvement and roadway improvement projects along Sarah East and the Jane Stanford Bay. So that's all I wanted to add. Again, thank you so much for the CRG members for making time this evening to go over the annual report. And we'll be on the sidelines. If there are any comments, we're here and for clarification.
Okay, thank you, Ramya. So we can now move to discussion and comments and questions from the CRG. Feel free to jump in and ask and share your comments. Yes.
Yeah, seems like Stanford's had a lot of success. COVID, obviously, played a role in some of these things, but what I've noticed is one is that that new car trips, that's been going great, and the other is it doesn't seem like you've dipped into the remaining 300,000 square feet in a few years. So I guess I have a few questions about that. Is that in part because you've been moving square footage, so you've been kind of adding to that? So there is maybe some new development, but it's slower than decommissioning and buildings. Yeah. And do you think COVID made some permanent changes in trips? Like, are there some people who can permanently work from home or a few days a week? Or what long-term role is COVID playing, do you think?
I know that for our staff and students, there has not been that big a change. But for our students and faculty, but for our staff, we do have some hybrid flexibility. So for instance, a portion of our staff works 2 days a week, but in the office. So that may have played a role in getting the net new trips to the level that it is right now. But I know the landscape is changing even for tech companies. So in the future, we'll see how that evolves.
That similar to other office buildings where we have such a change as a staff person, seeing our offices, it's just very different now, so much flexibility. People are sort of coming and going at different times, so like a lot of office buildings, we're all trying to sort of get a handle on what the future of office work and staff work and what our space needs will be.
Are employees happier?
Yeah,
they're ecstatic.
It's so flexible now, right? As opposed to that very rigid 9-to-5.
And I'll add one last comment, which is trying to maintain our robust TDM, even though we're still meeting this no new commute trip and we have office attendance down, there's this need to keep those programs up because at some point we could come back to full capacity, and we want to make sure that we've got all that infrastructure in place to get people continuing to use transit. So that's a big focus, and trying to continue to prioritize that even while we see across the bay transit use down so much. So it's a balancing act, I'd say.
And it seems like the TDM's going better in the morning than in the outbound afternoon. Is that the morning commutes are more staggered and people are like, 5 o'clock, gotta get out?
I don't know the data well enough to respond to that.
That's certainly apparent.
Yeah.
On Stanford Ave.
Oh, yeah.
I can follow up about that with a consultant as well. Mm-hmm. Because we've had a traffic monitoring consultant at ACOM working on the program for the past 20 years, so they have 20 years worth of data. So that question about the morning versus the evening commute, I can definitely run that by.
Yeah, but I think I have a note here that, you know, we're restarting in a pilot program, the Shopper Express, to help students go to the shopping centers, you know, without using individual vehicular trips. So we're still doing quite a bit of work to try to maintain, as Aaron said, all these different TDM programs and keep people walking, biking, and using transit.
I will confess, as one who has biked across campus numerous times over the last 30 years, I find the new layout to be terribly confusing. I live in College Terrace, and I've gotten lost several times. So
you keep going around the roundabout.
The roundabout?
Yeah, I keep going right, but yeah, that kind of thing. So it's, I assume I'll get used to it eventually, but it's rather frustrating. I actually wanted to ask about the sports areas. I noticed one of the things that's supposed to be updated is the softball area. Can you give me any clue as to what that might be like? One of the problems I have living in College Terrace is I get to listen to the announcements, and I'm not really crazy about that. As I understand, they're actually broadcast over the top of the audience and out into the community. Is there any possibility, as it gets redeveloped, that we could reverse that and blast it into campus instead of out into the community? Anyway, just what kind of thing are you guys intending for that?
I know the stadium is going to undergo quite a bit of renovation. There is a demolition piece as well to the press box, where we are gaining enough square footage back, but it's very minor. But it's mainly to get it to the current standards, because we want to make our sports facilities more competitive to your students who are really, you know, top of the class. So that's the effort that we want to upgrade a lot of our tennis, softball facilities so we can bring in more talent. That's what my understanding is.
We can look into it.
I will check on
it. Yeah, the change on the announcement.
I've lived there, as I say, 35 years. And it never used to bother me to hear the crowd yelling or hear the band playing, but a lot of the rah, 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 gets really old, particularly if you're trying to entertain or something. It's just, and I've tried calling the hospital, and nothing has ever happened out of that. So that's another frustration, but hopefully when you rework some of that area, that can be a consideration as to how to moderate the amount of noise that escapes into the community. That would be gratefully appreciated. I don't know about some of my other neighbors that live on other sides of the Stanford, but I know.
I see Ed here has a comment.
Yeah, a couple of related questions to what you were just talking about. I know that in the past, I mean, one of the reasons that the TDM has been affected, of course, is there haven't been people there, but another one is they've been moving people, staff, off campus.
Yeah.
To Redwood City and so on. So that, by definition, is going to keep the net new trips down, but it's not keeping the net new Stanford trips down on the peninsula, because now they're driving further if they live in Palo Alto. So obviously the whole greenhouse gas situation. So I guess that just gets me the current question of what's the plan? Presumably you don't need more office in Redwood City at this point, but is there still expansion to move people off campus and use the buildings here for something else? Staff or faculty instead of staff, or kind of what's the trend line look like?
I would say that we, as Rami said, we do have underutilized buildings on campus, and we're trying to figure out how to maximize efficiency and use the campus really for the academics. As you probably know, Redwood City is a staff
yeah.
campus. So there's nothing sort of completely fleshed out yet, but there is a lot of talk about how do we move you know, people to Redwood City who are serving more, who are student-facing, I should say, on campus who can be in Redwood City. And I will say that, you know, we have a really, our TDM programs expand to the Redwood City office. There's a fabulous shuttle that runs all day, every few minutes from the, Diana's all over the shuttle. So a lot of the TDM we see on campus extends, the level of service is extending to the Redwood City campus.
Another question that I have from the report is that, you know, it looks like your actual net parking spaces went down, and which is kind of odd, which means you took out some parking spaces.
Very un-American.
Well, it's just kind of odd that that happened in the building that, over there. And you know, you're way under the kind of planned amount of parking spaces of 2,300. So obviously part of that is the pandemic, but those, would you just put up another building that didn't need as much parking? Was that sort of a simple story?
So yeah, I can take that one. So we went down on our parking spaces primarily because we converted some vehicular spaces to a bike lane in Bowdoin. And because those spaces were underutilized, we were keeping that those spaces when we were building EVGR to avoid spillover issues to College Terrace. Uh-huh. But now that EVGR is built and we have Thoburn and Manzanita garages open, so we have enough parking for our students and our affiliates. So then we decided to reconfigure that piece in Bowdoin and change it to a bike lane because that was a missing link, and now we have better connectivity for our bicyclists.
Good plan. Good point. Thank you.
I will say that I see folks from the University Terrace neighborhood biking across through Bowdoin on a regular basis. So that is very heavily used, and I will attest to that.
You might not be able to or be allowed to talk about this, but I'm wondering if this approach of repurposing building or removing buildings so that you have more square footage, is that to extend the life of this GUP? Is there any plan to file for a new GUP that you're allowed to talk about, and we might expect something?
We don't have any immediate plans. We've been very clear and transparent that we were waiting for the community, the Stanford community plan process to kind of get to its fruition, which is this fall. And so we've been watching those policies closely to try to understand how those will affect the next step. We are, the pandemic and the pullout of the 2018 GUP sort of worked in tandem with one another to help us figure out how to just think about our space differently. So we have bought time to, by doing this efficiency thought experiment, because there really is a lot of capacity there in some of these buildings that are just underutilized. But at some point, we'll be at a point where we have academic needs that require us to move forward. We truly don't have a timeline for that at the moment. We're still pretty heavily involved with staff on the community plan update and thinking through how those policies affect, you know, the growth of the campus.
Well, it seems like good planning.
We hope so. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a good partnership with staff on the community plan.
So I have a question about off-campus housing, and that's currently Menlo Park. So I'm from Menlo Park. We've also got Palo Alto. Menlo Park, there's 8 hubs of off-campus housing. One of them is new, Middle Plaza, which has 215 housing units. The others are projects which I believe where Stanford has come in and is using existing housing, which obviously exacerbates the housing situation for many residents. There's 8 off-campus housing buildings within Menlo Park. There's 6 within Palo Alto. And this is on the website of off-campus housing options for students. Help. We are having housing issues. We are having housing affordability issues. For Stanford to come in and be taking these housing opportunities for our residents and to be subsidizing housing for the students, on one hand, great, and we love having the students and faculty and staff in our community, but it is very difficult when this is now taking up residential space mm-hmm. that could be for other community members, and very honestly, it's displacing some people. Mm-hmm. Can you speak at all to that?
I'll say, I'll make one comment, and maybe Diana, you can help me out here. I would, with regard to Middle Plaza, that is additive housing. So adding into the community, helping jurisdictions meet their arena goals, which is many are.
Let me stop you right there. You also brought in SoftBank, which is bringing in much more office, which will exacerbate arena goals. So, you know, give and take, no, it's not balancing. It is more housing, thank you.
Yeah, the only other thing, I mean, that is definitely a concern that we've heard from the community. Santa Clara County is in the midst of their housing element, you know, we're all familiar with the housing element, yeah. Menlo Park is. And, you know, Stanford has significant housing sites that have been identified as part of the housing element that would provide, you know, a large proportion of the housing for the unincorporated county on our campus. So that is currently being planned right now, and I think a couple of these sites have been in the housing element cycle before. Along Quarry, they're right next to transit, you know, there's a lot of really good things about these potential housing sites. So, you know, I would say that there is still planning work that is being done looking for additional housing.
So when those come online, will these other residential buildings go back to the community and be available to the community? I don't know if these are have been purchased by, for example, 825 Menlo Avenue is a large complex which is now full of Stanford students. Again, they're very welcome, but we used to have community residences there. So is it something where the intention is to move people back onto campus as these other housing, as the housing is built, or my best guess is everyone needs more housing.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think it's an everyone needs more housing situation. But one broad kind of fundamental thought that I think Stanford has on this, because we have heard from, you know, some of the jurisdictions where there's Stanford affiliates, and we hear a lot about, you know, we're taking units away from the community. We understand the effect on these communities, but our perspective is sort of see ourselves as part of this broad fabric ecosystem of the community around Stanford land. So there's a little bit of a difference in how it's thought about between, you know, members in the community and Stanford. And I think
I am a proud of Stanford alum. I don't feel that way.
Yeah.
It is something which is taking away from our community. We had Stanford, the Middle Plaza, definitely it's adding, although we also have the balance of many, many more office square footage of office and adding much more to arena goals in the future. But these other units, very honestly, and it's something which is not done transparently. And I know that there's many other single family homes that are also being purchased. And so one thing that I don't know and that we've been trying to find out is whether these are coming off the tax rolls or not, and would love to get that information.
If they're ground leased, they stay on the tax rolls. If they are rented, they are not.
Yes.
I've been down that many, many times, and that's the answer.
Well, and then, but there's also the piece where when they're, the property tax for the Stanford land, I believe it's only on the, anyway, it's not the full value of what someone would pay if a private party.
That's wrong. That's factually wrong. If you're talking about
The ground lease.
In fact, it's right now what's happening is that when a person buys a home on campus, the county assessor looks at it and says, well, the price that you paid is actually too little. If it was in Palo Alto, it would be higher price, and so they're being taxed at the higher Palo Alto price, not at the purchase price. So there's no reduction whatsoever. If anything, there's an increase. If it's a rented, that's a different issue.
Yeah.
But for the ground rent, taxes are paid under the rules of Propositions 13, that incorporates the idea that it's a fair market value, which the assessor views as higher than the purchase price on campus.
So, go ahead.
Oh,
Oh.
No, go ahead.
So what I was referring to is when you, if you look at, they're no longer showing up like on the Palo Alto Daily real estate. It looks like that's been, plug has been pulled, but that's where I used to be watching. And the prices, the purchase prices were below what another private party would have purchased the property
yes.
for. And I believe the reason why is because, as you were saying, there is a ground lease that is not included. So someone is paying for the structure. And so even though the property is turning over so that it is higher, you know, under Prop 13, you pay it.
But the assessor goes in and decides what a comparable price
But
is.
They do? Okay.
They yeah. do. And that's been a real shock, unfortunately, for
yeah.
a number of faculty
okay.
members. And I'm very sympathetic about that.
And what really happened is that when people go shopping for a house,
mm-hmm.
they figure out how much money they have and how much they can afford. And they, if they go on campus, they get a little nicer house than if they go on in Palo Alto. But they, most people max out how much they can afford just because housing is so expensive
mm-hmm.
that people end up doing that.
But I'm
so now, once they've done that, the county assessor has said, we're going to tax you as if that house were in Palo Alto. And so what's been happening is houses that sell for maybe $3 million have been assessed at $5
million. That's exactly what
$6 million. And they're being assessed at it and taxed at that larger amount of money, even though the person... if they were buying in Palo Alto,
mm-hmm.
would have still bought a $3 million house because they couldn't afford to buy a $5 million house.
And
so
that was
what
changed without warning a few years
and
ago.
And is that true, for example, in Palo Alto and in Menlo Park, when people are purchasing
yeah.
there on houses that are purchased, that are owned by Stanford
yes.
and the lease? Okay.
Yes.
Good to know.
Well, I'm not sure that's true in Menlo because those are sold most. I thought more at fair market value.
No, they're
but
not.
If not,
that,
then if
I assume if, San Mateo County Assessor does
yeah,
the same thing.
Probably doing the
okay.
same thing.
Do you know?
If I may, yeah, I would just say that obviously the tax system is really complex, and as you know, mentioned here, there's a lot of different ways that the tax situation gets handled.
Mm-hmm.
Stanford's been preparing some information to help sort of decision makers sort of understand all the various complexities of this, so we can loop back around with you. And
that would be fabulous. Yeah.
Provide some more information.
Right.
Thank
so
you.
We're working internally to try to untangle this and make it more legible.
Right.
I wouldn't mind seeing that as well, just because I think I know. But
right.
It's a community. It's an, it's a question I often hear from the community.
Right.
Yeah.
But
I think it's yeah.
Two issues.
Thank you.
Yeah, two issues along this line. The fact that it's leased land under tax assessment rule doesn't make any difference because a lease, a long-term lease under tax assessment rules is interpreted exactly as a fee simple transfer.
Right.
So that doesn't make a difference. What does make a difference, at least to homeowners on campus, which I am, is that because we're on unincorporated land, we do not get fire and police protection, but we have to pay additionally, in addition to the property tax, we pay Stanford to cover our pro rata part of fire and police and roads and and common space maintenance. So if you think about in Palo Alto, you pay a set of taxes and then you get fire, police, and everything. We pay this equivalent taxes for equivalent home, but then we don't get those. We have to pay separately for that too. So it's not true that there is this undertaxation.
Well, my concern, and I imagine the same as in Palo Alto, is in Menlo Park when we have a resident who is living in the community, and they are utilizing the fire and the schools and the police and the streets and all of that. So it, they really do utilize the services that the tax base pays for.
Yeah, there's a separate between living in Menlo Park.
Mm-hmm.
In Menlo Park, you get all the services.
Mm-hmm.
if you live on the Stanford campus, totally. It's unincorporated land, you
correct.
Don't get the services.
Understood.
And then you have to pay
correct.
It. So there's a differentiation between your community and the Palo Alto campus.
That makes sense. Thank you.
I just also wanted to welcome, you know, Arushi and Olivia. You joined a little bit late. We've done the roll call. So would you like to share any comments if you have questions for staff or for Stanford?
We do have a list of questions. And yeah, sorry again for being late. I guess one was something that you talked about, but I just wanted to clarify. You're talking about TDM. Are there Redwoods? So the Redwood City campus and I guess the Belmont campus, question mark, will they be included in the no net new trips requirements? Is that
that's a
decided
Santa Clara County?
Okay. Yeah, so yeah. We're at this time we're talking about the current stuff, which is
okay.
You know, 2000 gov. So for that purpose, we're really looking at just the Stanford academic campus in unincorporated county. You know, we do have, we have the community plans update, which is ongoing. And in fact, the next CRG meeting, which will be on June 8th at 6:30 p.m., the same location, we will have a presentation by staff and our consultant and group, specifically just for the updates to the community plan. So I would, you know, bring that question to that meeting. And any other questions you all may have. So. You know, we'll have a good opportunity to have that discussion prior to this going to the board for EIR certification and adoption in fall.
Just really quickly, though, that community plan is only valid for Santa Clara County, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And those are both the same.
And those are, off done and incorporated.
Yeah, and I will just say, for Menlo Park, be happy to talk with you. We're also very interested. Other cities in San Mateo County, I know Redwood City is as well. Yes, please.
Yeah,
you can. Yeah, a no net new trip sounds appropriate for you guys as well.
Can I just run through the list here? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And so the next question we had was sort of about the Quarry Road developments that you mentioned, and I think we've spoken about them in the past few months. Hi, Erin. we're just curious if you can say anything more about if there's any timeline or what sort of plan for those three sites.
Yeah, I'll just start and then, so I would say there's no timeline. These are sites that have been identified for several years by the county as being potential housing sites. And so right now we are just working in terms of a high level planning document for the housing element about saying these sites could be developed for housing, the location looks right, there's some estimates about the number of units, but there's no timeline associated with buying that housing. Thank you.
What are the estimates? I'm just curious what sort of the scale of possibilities.
I can talk a little bit to that. Yeah. So yeah, we do have, you know, the two Quarry Road sites identified, and there's also the site on in proximity to Escondido Village, EBGR location. So we're looking at, you know, densities of or capacities of say 600 to 800 units each on the Quarry Road site. And say about 900 units in the site, which is on East Campus. So that's really the density that we're looking at. Or it's really under consideration in the housing element at this time as opportunity sites. And of course, you know, the Quarry Road sites, as it was brought up earlier in the meeting, it's, you know, proximity to transit, so they need for good opportunity sites. So yeah. And we'll have more information, maybe specific to this, if you're interested, at the next meeting.
Thank you.
I'll take a note of that.
sort of connected to the next question, which is with sort of the new development that's planned and the off-campus housing that we were discussing earlier, is the focus for new housing units constructed or acquired undergraduate students, graduate students, faculty, staff, some mix? I'm just curious if there's any particular emphasis on what parts of the Stanford population this housing is targeted for both the Quarry and Escondido sites and off-campus housing. On the website, we've seen that the off-campus housing is mostly for graduate students, but I was wondering if you could speak to, as Stanford is looking at other housing acquisitions.
I would say that we don't have specific ideas yet. You know, we sort of develop, you know, as we said, we're working on the community plan, trying to make sure we get those policies set in place, and then we can make plans in terms of which groups need the housing. And, you know, we have internal guidelines about where the best place, you know, for students to be located, whether it's on campus or off campus. So unfortunately, I don't have a lot of detail for you right now at this point. But we do sort of look at it on an ongoing basis and try to make sure that we're providing the right kind of housing for the populations that need it.
I think, and then just to like, but on the question around the off-campus apartments, are they all for graduate students solely, or has there been like any off-campus apartments like so far that are going to for like faculty or staff?
I think it really depends. We have different buildings, and I think they're set up differently. I'll speak specifically. There's a Redwood City apartment, and I know that actually can be rented by staff. So it's not just students or faculty, and so it really depends on the building. And there's a whole separate sort of program for that.
And Middle Plaza is faculty and staff as well. Okay. Middle Plaza
project. It's only faculty and staff.
What's that, Jerry?
Middle Plaza is only faculty and staff.
I don't know about only, but I believe that's the focus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. My understanding is it is only faculty and staff.
Of the student housing that's offsite, do you have any idea what the percentage is of 9-month rentals as opposed to 12-month rentals?
No. We can look into that and get back to you, but we can talk to our faculty staff people if they would have that data back.
Okay.
And the staff housing, just because a lot of people are understaffed, is it mostly administrative staff or typically, what's the staff?
We don't facilitate, you can imagine what the housing portfolio stands for.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of layers of, there's a faculty staff housing group, we have a real estate group. I mean, it's very complex, and I don't have the depth of knowledge to speak to how we, there's waiting lists, there's prioritization. I don't know how it works. I wish you would be happy, to get that information and share it out at a future meeting, but can you speak to that?
No, I would just say that I've seen the spreadsheets are incredibly complicated. and also it's not something that's set in cement, right? It adjusts over time as the needs of the university change. So even if I have the data for you right now, I wouldn't say that's the case in 2 years. But I can follow up and try to get back to you with a little bit more information. I would just, staff or people that obviously are everything but faculty, and there's a lot of us, that work in Redwood City. And but there's a lot of us that are already lived in the community before we started working for Stanford. So the housing needs are slightly different. Thank you so much.
Hi, Jerry. Did you have any comments?
I always do.
Yes.
Most of them I'll send just directly to you. They're just little pieces. But one overall comment about the structure is that you when you're reporting back, sometimes you use AR-22 and sometimes it's fiscal year 22. My suggestion is, whatever the reporting year is, if you're referencing back to that, it helps to have it be AR, whatever it is, always. And I got a little confused at one point because I don't know if the reporting year is the same as Stanford's fiscal year, is it?
It is.
So Stanford has September
through
August. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. It's a part of the definitions in the introduction to the annual report, but I get your point.
It's spotted through there. And go, oh, wait, does this mean? Because when I say fiscal year, many fiscal years are different. Right. So anyway, that was an overall comment, and I'll just send you all the little things, my little picky things. Mostly what I want to do is talk a little bit, ask a few questions, obviously coming from me, about water and biological side of things here. And one of the things that I didn't quite understand is on the graduate, it's the GSE project on page 23, the new building, I think, what's it called, South, or the Graduate School of Education South, something like that.
South building.
So it's no longer Cumberly, Cumberly is now North, am I correct?
So that the South building is a new construction.
It's being constructed.
Not,
right.
Yeah, and it's built on vacant land. There's no demolition on
right,
that
exactly.
specific site. So the existing North building is a historic resource, and there's some renovations being done to the inner facade, and then mirroring the north building is the south building, if you see in that image, and there is a part of the Barnum Center, which was designated as not historic. Two out of three components of the building would be demolished.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
So it's,
So my question about that is about the trees that were removed or going to be removed. And I think I've got this correct, two oaks and 13 non-oaks, and they're being replaced by six oaks and three non-oaks. Now, I don't mind that because I prefer oaks to eucalyptus or whatever the non-oaks are, but I'm just, that's unusual. It's a very odd replacement pattern, you know, and usually it's like one to one, or in one place on that, you know, for that, for the tree incident that happened, it's a 10-to-1 ratio of replacement.
Right, that's for violations.
So I'm just wondering why they call that out.
Right, so under the 2000 CAP for tree mitigation, there is a 1-to-1 mitigation ratio for protected non-oaks, and it's a 3-to-1 ratio for protected oak trees.
Yeah.
But the way a tree is designated as protected, specific to Stanford, is if it's been a part of a prior land use approval on campus, for instance, an ASA or a site approval or a subdivision, and it's recorded as a protected tree in a prior approval. So not all trees are protected.
Yeah, I understand.
On Stanford campus. So the mitigation being proposed for that project is specific to only protected trees. So the unprotected trees, we can't require replacement of those trees, and that's not something Stanford for that project is proposing voluntarily.
Right.
So, we were able to require mitigation only for the protected trees.
Okay. Yeah. I understand that perfectly.
Yeah.
I think it might be, if somebody looks at that and thinks that out,
Okay, to call it out.
I understand.
Okay, I understand. So you want some more narrative in there to clarify.
I just think it might be helpful that people kind of touch you.
Designate
trees.
Which are, differentiate between the two classes.
Yeah.
Okay, I can add that.
Okay, not a criticism, just a curiosity. Also, you mentioned the Stanford Reservoir Pump Station rehabilitation. It's funny, I'm pretty knowledgeable about that stuff, and I don't know what that is. Can you explain, or somebody explain that a little?
Right.
It was under a project, page 27. And it was just mentioned. I don't think it was really called out.
That
I think it was
future.
Just in a chart.
It's an ASX term, the Brian Schultz's project. So I think that's what Jerry's mentioning. So
yeah.
So the pump station is undergoing some restructuring work.
Uh-huh.
And then PG&E has its equipment, the generator and everything, in SFPUC's easement, so which is public utility. And so we want to remove PG&E's generator to another location that's outside the easement. So that's the scope of the project. And it received approval in the last reporting period.
I'm just curious. I just hadn't heard about it. So it's really just it's not an addition. It's not related to water. It's not related to more water or less water.
Correct.
It's just a restructuring of that facility.
Pump station, and then it's not even upsizing the generator. It's mostly similar in size.
Yeah.
But we are removing it from SFPUC's right of way.
From the right of way, and putting it on Stanford property?
That's correct.
Oh.
And also moving it out of the drip line of trees.
Okay. That's good.
That's good.
So Reservoir 1 is one of the reservoirs in the bowl area of the dish.
So the restructuring is for the pump station for Reservoir 1. I'll have to refer to
it. I think, isn't it the one? Yeah, I think it's the one up on the dish.
So the pump station's away from the reservoir?
Oh, yeah. It's down by the creek, right? I assume.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's near the dish trail.
Someplace.
Okay, good. I'm always interested in that. Also, two more quick questions. In Appendix B, they talk about in AR3 having created a wetlands description consultation with the Corps. Is there a way to find that? I'd be interested in finding that.
Right.
If you could just send it to me, that'd be great.
You would be emailing the specific, so this is under which mitigation?
You want me to just email you on that?
Yeah, I'm getting a note of it, but if you want to just specify which specific condition?
Yeah, I just couldn't be able to, it's Appendix B, I think it's K5.
K5, okay.
Yeah, I think so. And under the same Appendix B, but on N3, they're talking about the detention basins. And again, it's not, I'm not worried about this, it's just I'd like a little bit more information. And they spoke, it's described, the one in the West Campus is described very thoroughly. But the one, I think it's called El Camino, you know, the one that's in that area.
The sports.
Yeah, yeah.
The sports field.
It doesn't even say when it went in, and where it describes the other stuff. So I would like to find out what it is, a little bit more description. It's odd to describe one fairly thoroughly and the other one, not just to mention it's there.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And were those activated during like the New Year's Eve rains? I mean, I don't think I've ever seen water in the retention basins.
Yeah, good question. The San Francisco should have been, for sure. I mean, I would just think of all the flows of all the buildings that are going in that direction.
Before we started, I made a comment about the fact that the where the creek along Stanford Avenue goes into the culvert.
Yeah.
That culvert blocked up.
Oh, my
God. And it flooded that whole upper Stanford Avenue or lower Stanford Avenue area down into Bowdoin and into people's yards and all that, and washed a whole lot of the DG pathway out into the street.
Wow.
It was a total mess. So I don't know whether it ever got down into the detention basins, which is where it would have gone later. But I will say, since I'm in an area that would have flooded had we not had sufficient detention on campus, and we didn't flood, it's good news. We flooded back in when there were the floods downtown, and nobody really realized that we got flooded, but we did. We had about 10 inches of water running down our street, which was not terribly helpful, and it flooded a bunch of businesses. And that has not happened since the detention facilities were put in. I know there's also detention pipes underneath the parking lots in EV. And that also has helped. Now, those probably were in use because the creek was not, that part of the creek was not overflowing.
Yeah.
So some of it works.
It'd be interesting to see some pictures of Peter. It'd be cool. I mean, they're kind of hard to see from the road. You have to actually get there. Yeah.
Oh, the detention basin?
The one on the West Campus, which is right off of Sand Hill.
And Jerry, for the installation of these detention basins, that information is in Appendix C. When Sarah, when the detention basin in Sarah and El Camino went in, and when the Best Campus went in, and then when the Stork Farm went in. I think it's AR2, AR4, and AR14, but
it's a while back.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a while.
Right.
Appendix C.
And thankfully, we haven't flooded since in our area.
And then one other just general comment. I really appreciate the whole sustainability report at the back. Astonishing good work is going on.
That's much better than what the previous stuff.
Yeah, so.
Much better.
Really, really helps out. And I love it that, even though I don't really appreciate building solar farms in the desert rather than other places, the fact that Stanford is now 100% solar is pretty phenomenal.
Do they have much power storage, batteries?
They do.
That's the kind of the big issue.
Well, they did.
Well, that's not how they store the energy.
Yeah.
The system relies upon hot water and cold water pumped to the building and they heat and cool at off times and store the hot water and cold water in very big tanks.
Yeah. And does solar tie into that?
That's solar energy that they're using to do it. So,
Like photovoltaic, can they do a way of storing
photovoltaic, they're buying in contract photovoltaic that's brought in there. They don't have a lot of batteries. There's some, but not a lot. But basically the storage is the hot water and the cold water, because that's the biggest use of energy, through tanks, which those hot water and cold water tanks are a lot cheaper than batteries to store energy. It's a very clever system.
We would expect nothing less from Stanford.
Well, not always.
Don't go there.
Hopefully they can figure out solutions for the rest of us too. Right,
okay.
Peter?
Thank you.
Sure. Tom, did you have any
Just
comments?
A couple of comments. This is kind of a broken record, but every year we deal with unauthorized tree removal and violations and not completion of the raptor surveys. And it comes up every year. I wish you would either figure out a way to say, when we get into these areas, we'll do an evaluation, and if trees have to come out, we'll make a decision. Because this whole violation process seems like it's just a rubber stamp.
Yeah,
you know?
After the fact.
Go in, do whatever you want, and then we'll deal with it afterwards. And I know that's not how, you know, it's really working, but the way it looks in the report is it looks negative, and I don't think it really is intended, or what Stanford is doing is intended to be something negative. It's just what you face when you do a fairly big development. So I'd like that cleaned up a little bit, because it bothers me every time I read it as a violation, or particularly not completing the raptor surveys, and it's just kind of like, okay, it's a matter of course, we'll do it every year.
That should be done before you start on anything.
Yeah, I think it would be just better to have some kind of process that is realistic in terms of field checks, make decisions, and have a framework for that, whether it's in this process or someplace else. Secondly, I know in terms of off-campus housing, a community like Portola Valley is very encouraging to Stanford to come out and help them reach its RENA numbers. They've got, you know, some properties out there that are not insignificant in terms of Stanford, and Stanford, I think, can be a really good neighbor in that situation in helping a community that's kind of out in the boondocks where you guys have some land. So I think it's kind of mixed depending on the community and where you're coming from. The last question I just have, it's a point of information. Some around 12,000 square feet addition to Maples that's planned. What is that?
You want us to answer in the order?
Why don't you go ahead and respond to Maples' question?
So the first question on tree violations, I think the county is mandated to report on updates as part of GUP compliance. So that's why they show up. And in the last two reporting cycles, we've not had any violations, but the work that we do to mitigate the violations that happened 2 years ago is still sort of taking shape. So that's why Charter puts in language that for Rio Dolores, the trees will be planted next year. For three in one violations, we've done mitigation. And Tom, sorry about the fact that it doesn't look good on a report, but that's the reason my understanding is it goes into the report. But as a community, as a construction community within land buildings and real estate, we have done a concerted effort to organize ourselves better and to educate ourselves and our project managers of tree regulations, because we care about the trees and we care that we meet county's expectations. And there was a period where we were getting violations primarily because I think our crew did not really understand what sometimes due to tree disposition changes, they wouldn't really route it to the county. They didn't understand the process, but now we have a better handle on it, and we involve Charu in a lot of those calls and ask her that, okay, does this require modification? And there are times when she's able to process it easily for us. There are times where it's changing locations to the point where she needs to review it all over again. So it's just the semantics in terms of part of the process we report it, but it's good news that we haven't had a violation in the last 2 years. So that was the first question.
Is that accurate? I thought there was a violation in this last.
So in this reporting period, it's only being reported in the report that the tree replacement was completed. So I understand the point that you were making, because it appears that the violation occurred in this reporting period. So we will, I'll look at the language a little bit closely to clarify that we're just reporting the replacement.
I think it should be helpful, so it doesn't look like it's a continuing negative thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
And then Maples?
Yeah, so Maples Pavilion is undergoing a renovation in the sense that they are expanding underground for putting in new walkers. I believe there are going to be shower facilities as well. And it's a total gup of a little less than 12,000 square feet.
And it's underground?
It's all underground.
It's underground, yeah.
I went to hearing just this month on April 7th, I believe, last week. So I can definitely send across more details on that. So this has been approved, the ASA has been approved. It would get reported next year in that report.
Nice to hear that it's underground.
That's a big construction process, though. If you put anything 11,000, 12,000 square feet underground, that's a big deal.
And they're existing buildings.
Yes. Shades of the T-line in San Francisco.
So any additional comments, questions? Okay, so I think with that, if you don't have any additional comments or questions, we can conclude the meeting. The meeting would be adjourned at 7:35 p.m. The next meeting is on June 8th, 2023 at 6:30 p.m. And we'll conclude with that. And thank you all for your participation.
Thank you.
Did you like it?
Nice to see everybody.
Yes, it's been a while. Thank you so much for the effort of changing the date on next week.
Oh, yes, of course.